President answers questions about the economy.
Did he have any answers about what to do?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, hello, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Bill Radke, and this is the Midday Update from Marketplace.org on a Friday, September 10th. More on Mr. Obama's next set of proposals to kickstart the economy coming up, what the proposed Islamic Center and mosque near the site of Ground Zero will do for businesses already there. And later, Mark Hurd plays musical chairs, but we ask if anyone cares. The news of the week in rhyme in less than 60 seconds time.
Oh, yes.
But first.
President Obama gave his 8th White House news conference since taking office, his first in at least 4 months.
These policies of cutting taxes for the wealthiest Americans, of stripping away regulations that protect consumers, running up a record surplus to a record deficit, those policies finally culminated in the worst financial crisis we've had since the Great Depression.
Most Americans want to know what to do about the sputtering economy. We do know who the president's tapped to help figure it all out inside the administration, Austin Goolsbee. An economic advisor during Mr. Obama's campaign, Goolsbee succeeds Christina Romer as the chairman of the White House Council of Economic Advisors. Marketplace's Scott Tong is with us from our Washington Bureau to talk about what the president had to say about the economy and what he plans to do. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning, Steve.
How did the president describe how his administration is going to dig the country out of this hole?
Well, he reiterated what he's been saying all week. The president wants to spend money to build roads and infrastructure, $50 billion worth of money. And he's proposing to give businesses 2 big tax breaks. Number one, to do research and development. And number two, to let companies that invest in new equipment write those costs off immediately instead of over several years. Now, as far as his narrative, the president said more than once that he inherited an economy, in his words, tipping over a cliff. And what he did is came in and helped prevent a depression. He said 750,000 jobs have been created this year. Not enough, but he says his administration is moving the country in the right direction, Steve.
And how doable will those programs be to get through, Scott?
Well, this is Washington, and there's an election going on, so not easy. The president said next month he anticipates a battle with Republicans over tax cuts. The White House wants to extend them for what they consider the middle class, but not for the wealthiest.
And what I've got is the Republicans holding middle class tax relief hostage because they're insisting we've got to give tax relief to millionaires and billionaires to the tune of about $100,000 per millionaire.
Now, during the question, Steve, the president denied that his administration has responded late to this crisis, as some have said. He said, quote, "We are hardly Johnny-come-latelys to this recession." And finally, he also talked up the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau that was created by the new financial reform law. He said it would help consumers, but he was cagey on who he will nominate to head it up.
But he did mention Elizabeth Warren by name, so, and as did reporters.
He did.
So we will.
But
we'll...
he said, we'll keep you posted on who we nominate.
That's right. That's right. To be continued, as he said.
Yep.
All right. Marketplace's Scott Tong reporting from Washington. Scott, thanks.
You're welcome.
So you just heard how the president feels about the economy. Now we turn to Chris Lowe, chief economist at FTN Financial. He is with us, as he is every Friday from New York, with more analysis about what the president can do. Hello, Chris.
Hi.
So the president's probably going to say today that the economy is healing. How are you feeling about this recovery today?
Well, look, you know, the economy is growing, and as time extends from the recession, it's becoming more apparent that it is, in fact, following a path that's absolutely typical of the last several recoveries. The problem with that is that the script calls for stimulus to get things going, and of course we had that.
Mm-hmm.
But then after that, consumers were supposed to take over by borrowing against their mortgages and using that money to stimulate consumption. And that seems to be the place where things are falling down. That's the big challenge for the president, of course, is what to do in the absence of that refinancing boom, which took us out of the last two recessions.
So with the president talking and his opponents talking about spending proposals today and tax cuts, how, as an economist, Chris, how fixated are you on the government's actions?
Well, I tell you what, we, like the bulk of the public, are focused on the unemployment rate. What we need is something that's going to bring that unemployment rate down enough to get income going to drive the economy forward. And that is the big question mark. I think we need government solutions for this, but frankly, I don't know what it is they're going to come up with that will actually be effective.
Okay. Chief Economist Chris Lowe at FTN Financial. Thanks, as always.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Jill Schlesinger joins us every Friday as well. She's editor-at-large over at CBS Money Watch. And Jill is also talking to us from New York about what the president plans to do, what are his options. Good morning, Jill.
Good morning.
So how does the president sell his economic plan?
Chop it up into three pieces. $50 billion in infrastructure over 6 years, $30 billion in accelerated business deductions for equipment purchases, and $100 billion in research and development. The plan served two purposes. $180 billion will inject a shot of adrenaline into the nation's sagging economic recovery and hopefully spur job creation, and the money will help address long-term needs like fixing the nation's rails, roads, and runways.
And he'll use the word like infrastructure, right?
That's, oh, yeah.
That a lot.
Love that.
So is it going to create jobs, though, Jill?
I unfortunately don't think so. Economists that I've spoken to say that the large-sounding proposals are unlikely to make a meaningful impact on spending or jobs. And although the recession has claimed over 7 million jobs, this is actually a long-term structural change. Private employment today stands at about the same level as 1999 due to technological,
Wow.
to technological advances, globalization, and corporate outsourcing.
Wow. Jill Schlesinger, editor-at-large over at CBS Money Watch, who joins us every Friday. Jill, thanks.
Thank you.
Boeing and Lockheed Martin both announced major cost-cutting moves this week. And why would that be? Well, apparently these defense industry giants believe the Pentagon when it says it will cut spending significantly. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
There's lots of pressure on the Obama administration to cut the budget deficit, and non-defense spending has already been pared down.
So that puts defense squarely in the bullseye.
Gordon Adams is a defense industry analyst with the Stimson Center. He says procurement spending will be targeted first. The Pentagon won't buy as many new bombers or ships, so suppliers are tightening their belts.
The industry is beginning to lay off people, is beginning to look to areas that they can sell off pieces of their business.
About 25% of Lockheed Martin's senior managers have taken early retirements. Boeing is consolidating its military aircraft business. Todd Harrison is with the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. He says the defense industry as a whole is trying to get into non-military ventures.
A lot of the technologies that defense companies have could be applied to other civil government agencies, things like NASA, FAA.
Harrison expects defense spending to slide for the next 10 to 15 years. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Friday, September 10th. I'm Steve Chiotakis. For the latest look at the markets, check out the numbers at our website, marketplace.org. We're going to get a take now on the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics around the world, and how it affects us here in the United States. As the economy is slowly, very slowly, getting better this year, so too is the expectation that global oil demand will grow. But the International Energy Agency today said that growth isn't likely to last into next year. And that's a certainty, the IEA says, if the global economy gets weaker. That's not a very nice anniversary present for the oil cartel OPEC, which turns 50 today. Way back on September 10th, 1960, a conference kicked off in Baghdad, which led to OPEC's formation. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is with us from our London Bureau with the latest. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Steve.
So looking back 50 years, has OPEC been a success?
It's done pretty well for its members. The price of oil was only $3 a barrel in 1960. Today, it's around $74. That's not been great for the rest of us, of course. And there's also the issue of volatility. When the cartel was born, its stated aim was price stability. And that it certainly hasn't achieved. If you remember, oil was $147 a barrel only 2 years ago. The price has been all over the place.
Yes, it has. I remember those days. So the cartel hasn't been a win for the rest of us. Are we stuck with OPEC? like for another 50 years?
Well, for a few more years at least. The big threat is Iraq, oddly enough, which is still a member. If Iraq gets its act together and produces as much oil as it can, four times more than it's producing today, that'll mean a lot more oil from OPEC and more difficult for the cartel to control prices. And it could fall apart. But Leo Drolis of the Center for Global Energy Studies says Iraq isn't going to pay back in full production anytime soon.
It could be 5 years from now, it could be 10 or even more. So OPEC still has a bit of mileage left in it before it starts to come under pressure.
Longer term, of course, OPEC will come under pressure as oil reserves dwindle and renewable energy sources start playing a bigger role.
All right. Marketplace's Stephen Beard reporting from London. Stephen, thanks.
Okay, Steve.
Having grown up in the South, I always remember eating black-eyed peas and turnip greens on New Year's Day. Well, today is the final day of Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish calendar New Year, and the Jewish people usually mark the event by eating sliced apples and honey. But counterfeiters in Israel are trying to take advantage of that tradition. From Jerusalem, Daniel Estrin reports.
In Israel, this time of year is especially sweet for honey manufacturers. More than a million jars of the stuff are sold for Rosh Hashanah. That's 40% of annual sales in Israel, sold just for this holiday. But a few weeks back, an Israeli honey producer alerted the National Honey Association that he found imitation honey in grocery stores. Instead of being the land of milk and honey, this year you can add to that list melted sugar and artificial flavoring. Herzl Avidor, the president of the Honey Association, got his hands on a jar of the imitation stuff and took a taste.
The taste of it, I mean the smell of it, give us a hint that it is something not honey.
A lab test confirmed his suspicions and all 11 tons of the product were destroyed. This is not the first time an Israeli counterfeiter has tried to take advantage of the peak honey sales period. In the meantime, it advised Israeli consumers to stick to well-known brands. From Jerusalem, I'm Daniel Estrin for Marketplace.
Tomorrow is the 9th anniversary of the September 11th terrorist attacks on our country. There is a memorial service at Ground Zero in New York. And a few blocks north, rallies are expected in front of the now well-known site of a planned Islamic center and mosque. Ashley Milne-Tide asked some business owners in the neighborhood whether the center might help or hurt their bottom line.
For such a controversial place, the future mosque sits on a pretty dull block. The back of an office building towers over one side of the street. On the other, there's a bar, a supermarket, and a couple of smaller stores. One block away, Pemba Sherpa is huddling behind his tiny candy and newspaper stand. He says business never quite recovered after 9/11. Then some of his customers got laid off during the recession. He says the mosque is fine with him, but he's not sure it'll help sales much.
I don't think there's any difference now. I don't think there's any difference, good for or bad for the business, you know what I mean? I'm hoping more people come down here, not only the mosque, some other things also, you know, so our business will grow up.
Across the street, customers search through the sale racks at clothing store De Janeiro. Manager Vardwati Prashad says the Islamic Center is boosting her sales even before it's been built. Muslim men already come to pray at the current site.
And especially now is the Muslim holiday. They bring the kids and the wives. They come, and when they come to the mosque, they come in my store.
She says the new building will help improve the area.
A lot of buildings over here, they close out. They're for rent. Nobody coming down this area to rent.
You can see abandoned storefronts nearby. Still, according to the Downtown Alliance, last year more businesses opened in this area than closed. Convenience store owner Alpesh Jani is happy to talk about how well he's doing.
I don't have any complaints. So far, it's very good.
But when I bring up the mosque, he turns away.
I'm Indian and I'm Hindu, so I don't want to give any comments.
A lot of other store owners wouldn't talk either. The debate over the mosque has become so heated, it seems even the economic angle is off limits. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Friday, September 10th. I'm Bill Radke. Remember, for the latest look at the markets, you go to the numbers at marketplace.org. Now to our series on how the recession and recovery are being felt in the heartland. A lot of Americans live in the flight path of an airport, but most of those planes take off and land during the day. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson found an airport in Tennessee where the real action happens at night, and residents don't seem to mind.
That might sound like an airport runway, but it's actually a leafy residential neighborhood in Memphis called Cooper Young, and it's right in the flight path of Memphis International, home of FedEx.
It's been going on so long, you just don't even think anything about it. It's like living next to a railroad track, I guess.
I caught up with Steve Crayer taking the garbage out at his Cooper Young home. That's just a few miles north of the airport.
I'd hate to think what Memphis would be like if FedEx wasn't here.
That's easy for Crayer to say. He's one of the 32,000 Memphians who work for the city's top employer slash noisemaker, FedEx. His neighbor, Kip Gordon, isn't.
Can you sleep through it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and at this point, honestly, I've been here so long with it that I think if it stopped, I might have problems sleeping.
In fact, University of Memphis sociologist Phyllis Betts told me it's as if FedEx CEO Fred Smith can do no wrong here.
Fred Smith is like the biggest thing next to Elvis.
Well, if that's the case, then I'm going to Graceland, the main FedEx sorting facility at Memphis International. The action starts every night around 11 p.m. FedEx VP John Donovan has invited me up to the company's control tower.
Total aircraft inbound tonight would be about 144. I think it's right about 1.6 million packages is what we'll sort tonight.
All those planes coming in from as far away as Hong Kong land within a couple of hours, making this the world's busiest cargo airport. The planes are unloaded and all the packages are swiftly sorted through a matrix of conveyor belts. After that, they're loaded onto different planes, and around 2 a.m., it's takeoff time. The airport authority says it gets about 12 complaints a year about the noise, though a spokesman joked, most airports get at least 12 noise complaints a day. In Memphis, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
And Jeremy asked everybody he met in Tennessee whether they're seeing signs of the recovery. You can watch his slideshow and let us know what signs you're seeing at marketplace.org. California passed a law a few years ago to cut carbon emissions, and now there's a proposition on the November ballot to put that measure on hold until the state economy improves. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Eve Tro reports.
California's unemployment rate is one of the highest in the country, more than 12%. State Assemblyman Dan Logue says energy costs will go up if California makes companies reduce emissions as planned. And then...
we're going to have an exodus of businesses either leaving or closing. It's just not the right time.
Logue's Proposition 23 would suspend California's so-called global warming law until unemployment drops to 5.5% and stays there for a year. Georgetown University economist Vicky Arroyo says energy costs have gone up under California's emissions law, but those extra dollars drive a growing clean energy market.
Why would they cut off this progress in an area that's showing growth when so many other areas of the economy are not?
The two sides of the issue are head-to-head in spending on the ballot measure. Two Texas oil companies funded most of the $8 million behind Proposition 23 thus far. Clean energy venture capitalists have put up almost $7 million to fight it. In Los Angeles, I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
And finally, all the business news we could fit in a Marketplace minute.
The head of HP, Mark Hurd, we don't know what exactly occurred. Suspicious expenses, flimsy defenses. The board wasn't taking his word. So then Oracle said in reply, we'll take him. Hurd's a great guy. Now, as of this writing, the two firms are fighting, and I still have no idea why. Then there's BP's claim they're not solely to blame for the leaking that came from the rupture and flame. And there's more fiscal drama surrounding Obama because he's defending an increase in spending. And if he relaxes some corporate taxes, the deficit grows. Is it worth it? Who knows? And goodbye to the CEO of Nokia from Marketplace.org. In Los Angeles, I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. Have a great weekend. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.